This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Thanks for downloading Analysis, the program about the ideas that shape the world. In this edition, the work of a relatively obscure Lebanese-American philosopher has captivated Downing Street, including the Prime Minister. Janan Ganesh of The Economist interrogates this relationship.
Hampstead Heath is a vast, wild park in North London. One day last December, I took a walk through here with two of the most senior policy advisers to the Prime Minister, Steve Hilton and Rohan Silver. Also there was a Lebanese-American writer and former Wall Street trader called Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He may seem an unusual person for two busy Downing Street staff to spend a day with, but Taleb's ideas are hugely influential on the government. His central insight is about how little we know, an idea captured by the title of his book, Black Swan.
The Black Swan, page 21. Before the discovery of Australia, people in the old world were convinced that all swans were white. The sighting of the first black swan might have been an interesting surprise for a few ornithologists, but that is not where the significance of the story lies. It illustrates a severe limitation to our learning from observations or experience, and the fragility of our knowledge. One single observation can invalidate a general statement derived from millennia of confirmatory sightings of millions of white swans.
The point Nassim Taleb is making is that we don't know very much, especially about the future. When we make confident statements, we're often embarrassed when new facts prove us wrong. This problem has preoccupied philosophers from Plato in the 4th century BC to Karl Popper in the 20th century. But they are long dead. Nassim Taleb is alive and has the run of the Prime Minister's house.
I like going to 10 Downing, seeing the office of the most powerful person in his t-shirts and jeans. That definitely gives me another image of authenticity.
The man in his t-shirt and jeans is David Cameron. The admiration is reciprocated. Taleb has described the Prime Minister as extraordinary and the best thing we have left on this planet. I'm Janan Ganesh, political correspondent for The Economist, and in this week's analysis, I'll look at the implications of this story of mutual attraction for the way we're governed. What does it tell us about David Cameron's particular brand of conservatism? The Conservatives first approached Taleb when they were in opposition, searching for big ideas. They hit it off, and before long, Taleb was talking to the then leader of the opposition in front of an audience at the Royal Society for the Arts in London. Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator magazine.
To me, what really emphasised David Cameron's interest in Nassim Taleb was when the two of them did an open debate with each other. Here you've got the leader of the opposition standing up in the platform with a Lebanese academic discussing political theories. Now, you don't tend to see that very much in Britain.
Let me kick off. One thing I I mean, it's the danger of reading someone's book and it just confirms some of your prejudices and that's why you like it. We were talking that beforehand. But one of the things I take out of Nassim's work is that you've got to understand the importance of institutions and people rather than thinking it's all about rules. That was one of the things I drew out of your thinking.
I agree.
And it was fairly obvious listening to the conversation, but they agreed in broadly the same thing. And David Cameron isn't the sort of guy to say, here is my guru, I believe in what he says. But the fact that he was willing to go up and have a discussion about political theory with a guy who was still seen as a maverick, I think sent me anyway a very powerful message that Nassim Taleb is probably the closest thing which Cameron has to a guru.
Can I say, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me along and letting me come along and bathe in your reflective glory. Nassim.
So who is Nassim Nicholas Taleb? He was born in Lebanon and raised in a highly academic Greek Orthodox household. He studied in France and then in America before starting a career in finance. During his time in Wall Street, he noticed that investors would make overconfident predictions about the future. He began to base his own investment strategy on caution and ended up making money from the 1987 crash. He used the freedom to go away and pursue his intellectual interests, especially his theory of randomness. Now he writes books expounding his ideas, and he does it with some acclaim. The Sunday Times described Black Swan as one of the 12 most influential books since the Second World War.
People think that Black Swan thinking requires constant paranoia. That is not true. It requires finding out which Black Swans can really hurt you and which domains are Black Swan prone.
Here's Nassim Nicholas Taleb's idea. Random events can hurt us, but he has a way of guarding against them. He calls these events black swans. Just as we once thought that all swans were white, because we had only ever seen white swans, we also thought the economy would keep growing forever, because it had done for so long. Taleb says we're vulnerable to black swans because we're overconfident about how much we know. Instead of proceeding with caution, we're dangerously bold. His mission is to relieve us of that confidence. And, thanks to his Lebanese roots, he's more familiar with random, shocking events than most. Fraser Nelson.
I suspect that for Taleb, there was a major life-changing experience for him which informed his economic views, and that was when the Lebanese War broke out. I mean, Lebanon, it's funny to think of it now, but it was an incredibly peaceful country, which for centuries, for generations, never really had any kind of civil strife. And when the war broke out, people like Taleb's family, they'd go to Cyprus or something thinking, right, we're going to hide out here for 3 or 4 weeks, however long this nonsense lasts for, because things will go back to normal, they always have. And they didn't. Lebanon has been war-torn pretty much ever since. His country was hit by a massive black swan event, which nobody would have predicted. And I think this informs the way that he thinks about life. I think that Taleb's philosophy makes you remember, or encourages you to remember, that what we think about as permanent could dissolve in a second.
The key to understanding Nassim Taleb's theory is that not all areas of human life are the same. In some areas, extreme cases don't matter very much. In others, such as the economy, they can completely wipe you out.
If I randomly gather 1,000 people from the world's population and put them on a scale, and you add to that sample the heaviest person on the planet, that person will represent 0.3%. So you can have exceptions in some domains, but these exceptions are not consequential. However, socioeconomic life is very different. If you have the very same sample of 1,000 people and add to that sample the wealthiest person on the planet, he'll be worth 50 billion and the remaining 1,000 would be worth 1 to 2 million, all right? So you realize that there are some domains in which the exception matters a lot.
Nassim Taleb doesn't stop at merely observing randomness. He says we have to make ourselves robust to these events. Indeed, he has started to talk about anti-fragility. This means our economy should not only be able to withstand stress, but to gain strength from it, just like muscles and bones do. David Willetts, Minister for Universities and Science, and the government's leading intellectual, sees a link between Talib's caution and the coalition's fiscal policy of austerity.
Part of what's given Black Swan so much traction is that if you do the kind of thought experiment that he does in the book, would people sitting around 5 years ago have said there is going to be a monumental financial crash across all major Western countries? And so the big events that now shape the world today are not ones that barely anyone was forecasting 5 years ago. So he's correct that these big uncertainties do remind us of how limited the foresight of governments and commentators can be, and therefore it's an argument for prudence, and certainly an argument for prudence in the public finances, yes.
So this is the sober reality that I have to set out for the country today. We are not alone in this. Many countries around the world have been living beyond their means, and they too are having to face the music.
So one way in which we can make ourselves robust is by running a very cautious, conservative fiscal policy. This way, we can afford for things to go wrong. Talib says nature is a guide. After all, we're born with more vital organs, such as kidneys, than we strictly need.
When you have an extra kidney, you don't have to predict the source of harm, whether it's going to be a snake or a cancer or whatever. You don't have to predict the environment. Likewise, if you have a lot of savings, you don't have to predict the cause of the next crisis. But if you have debt, you need to be very accurate in your forecast of the future. This is the first principle, is a non-predictive system, a system as immune from prediction error as you can get. That's the first. And from it, you know, to emulate nature, we could just say we don't want government debt or minimal government debt, or you want to have surplus in the good years. It is completely immoral, all right, to stick your descendants, the future generation, with the cost of your mistakes. See, even if debt is economically efficient, you're not bearing the risk, the future generation are bearing the risk of the mistake, the cost of the mistake. You can't transfer that.
Debt is a mistake. So the government's austerity program is in line with Talib's theory of randomness and robustness. In fact, he would argue that Britain made a huge mistake by running deficits during the boom years. But avoiding debt is not the only way we can make ourselves robust. Another way is to make sure that in both the public sector and the private sector, nothing should be too big.
I think size is not natural. It's very harmful, particularly when it hijacks a state. So I'm against large corporations, but at the same time, against large government. I'm for decentralization more than reduced role of government. You want to build a society that is robust and with a small amount of these large exposures to unnatural black swans.
He's basically saying the bigger they come, the harder they fall. And this is, again, one of the key lessons of the crash. We had this concept of too big to fail. We couldn't afford to let the banks go bust, so the taxpayer had to bail them out with calamitous consequences for the public finances and for the nationalised institutions themselves. He is arguing that you can never rule out failure in any given institution. So you should look around the country and think, what would we do if, for example, Tesco were to go bust? Does Tesco now have such a large share of our market that if it were to collapse, people would go hungry? Now, if that's the case, then you need to start breaking up Tesco or give it an incentive to break up itself. If restaurants go bust, he says, then nobody really cares. Really, you can go to another restaurant. Mistakes will happen all the time. But if you are now reliant on companies, be it a bank, be it a supermarket, be it anything else, if you're dependent on them not going bust, then you're taking a huge, big risk as an economy and a society, and you should be aware of that risk and trying to minimise your exposure. So the scale itself is a problem because it simply is an accident waiting to happen.
Nassim Talib believes there is safety in smallness. Small institutions can go under without threatening the whole system. They can also compete with each other to improve their performance. But he doesn't just apply this to banks and companies. He also thinks the state should be designed on the same principle.
There's a very close link between black swan thinking and health or education, because it's wrong to think of the health service or the education system as a great big monolith, thousands of GPs, thousands of schools in some kind of pyramid, which ends up at Whitehall with that famous, notorious expression of Bevan that the sound of a bedpan falling in an NHS ward should be heard in Whitehall. Instead, we think of them as an ecosystem, as a network, where there are individual schools, individual GP practices, individual hospitals. They have to be given some local identity. And that is black swan thinking, because what Taleb does is reminds us of the perils of being big. And that is true of big banks, it's true of big business, and it's also true of the big traditional monoliths of the welfare state.
Nassim Taleb believes so strongly in smallness that he says the ideal form of government is the city-state. There are some of this in the government's enthusiasm for pushing power away from Whitehall. It's creating city mayors, elected police commissioners, and independent schools in the state sector. So austerity is not the only reason Taleb identifies with David Cameron.
There is a small, it's beautiful notion that's a little romantic, and I tried to put some math behind it when I discovered scale effects. My whole central idea revolves around prediction errors, or human error, typically, in form of underestimation of rare events. When you have small budgets, people seem to manage them a lot better than large-scale projects.
So if you were advising David Cameron or anyone running a country, the emphasis would be on what you could call fiscal caution, so running surpluses whenever possible.
Yes.
And also a dispersal of power in both your economic and your political systems. Nothing too big, nothing too sustainable.
And also have as much decision-making at a local level by elected people.
As we walked through the heath, Taleb invoked his own intellectual heroes. Edmund Burke, Michael Oakeshott, Karl Popper. These thinkers represent an old-fashioned type of conservatism that we haven't seen since before Thatcher. They question how much we can ever really know, and they prefer the small and the local over the big and the central. That was when it dawned on me that Taleb, despite being a creature of the modern age, is actually quite a traditional sort of conservative.
You certainly can link Taleb to that long strand of English conservative thought, whose social origins are kind of trusting the local justice of the peace, trusting the local squires to administer their own part of the country well. And it's Burke's little platoons, and it is the sort of Oakeshottian celebration of the sort of local community in England.
David Willetts. Edmund Burke, who wrote in the late 18th century, is perhaps the intellectual father of English conservatism. He was suspicious of the French Revolution and the Enlightenment. He preferred tradition, hierarchy, and incremental change. Above all, he admired small, local institutions, the famous little platoons. Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator magazine.
I'm quite struck by how Taleb doesn't say that if you have a government spending, for example, 50% of GDP, then that's a bad thing. He says the real problem is how it's structured. And I think this government is quite interested in being able to change the structure of the government machine, even if it's not able to change the size by as much as it wants. I think David Cameron knows that he is not going to be able to shrink this government to be, for example, from 50 to 35% of GDP, but he might be able to change the size and the way things are delivered, and he might be able to make faster progress, focusing on structures rather than size, which is very much part of Taleb's message.
And that explains policies like schools reform, police commissioners, health reform, and so on.
That's right. It explains why you move the education system from something which is where curriculums can be dictated by ministers to a system where you've got lots of independent state schools competing with pupils. That's a structural reform. You're not saying there should be fewer schools or more schools. It's not about size. It's simply about structure.
So Taleb deplores the idea that the country can be run by trained technocrats making calculations from Whitehall. But can this humility about how much we know go too far? Can it become a menace to reason and the Enlightenment?
The Black Swan, page 190. We are not predisposed to respect humble people, those who try to suspend judgment. Think of someone heavily introspective, tortured by the awareness of his own ignorance. I will call such a person an epistemocrat. To me, utopia is an epistemocracy, a society in which anyone of rank is an epistemocrat. It would be a society governed from the awareness of ignorance, not knowledge.
It's become apparent to me that Taleb is taken very seriously by the government. Is that an encouraging or a worrying thing?
Frightening, I would say. It depends, of course, which parts they're taking, but if it's this blanket scepticism that we're always at the mercy of the black swans, then I would be very frightened of it.
That was John Worrell from the London School of Economics. He is a professor of philosophy, and he's a disciple of one of Taleb's intellectual heroes, Karl Popper, who more than anyone else wrote about the limits of our knowledge. But he thinks Popper would be wary of Taleb.
I mean, I think that the impression a reader would get from Taleb, I mean, he's very slippery in that, you know, he says one thing in one place and then he qualifies it later on. But the impression that they would get is that you can never be reasonably certain about a theory or about what's going on. Now, I of course, accept that one ought to be sceptical about the financial models that he talks about because they haven't been tested properly. But let's not generalise, which he very readily does.
The Black Swan, page 23. Black Swan logic makes what you don't know far more relevant than what you do know. Think of the terrorist attack on September the 11th, 2001. Had the risk been reasonably conceivable on September the 10th, it would not have happened. Fighter planes would have circled the sky above the Twin Towers, airplanes would have locked bulletproof doors, and the attack would not have taken place, period.
A section very early in the Black Swan book, he says that September the 11th was not conceivable on September the 10th, which is, I'm sure, absolute nonsense. It's not my field at all, but I would bet any amount of money that there were people who conceived exactly of that possibility and decided that given the high cost, it wouldn't have been clear then, and it's not even clear after the event, I think, that it would have been a good idea to put bulletproof, as they did in the end, of course, bulletproof doors on every cockpit of every plane. The intellectual crime the whole time, I think, is to generalise too quickly, which part of the time is what Taleb himself is saying, but it sounds like his impact on the Conservative Party is exactly an instance of that, that you don't really need to think about individual cases because you know that there'll be black swans around, so, you know, it's all search me, Gov, whether what we're going to do is right or not, so we better not do very much, and it's a bad mistake, I think.
So, in its purest form, black swan thinking can paralyse government. We lose faith in our ability to achieve progress through reason and planning. Conservatives in particular have historically been accused of this kind of defeatism.
Taken too far, it can mean that government becomes overly incremental, perhaps even anti-rational, anti-scientific. Is there a strain of modern conservatism which goes too far in that direction?
There is a danger of a kind of crippling doubt that you can't do anything. And indeed, wasn't it Republicans? Someone said of American Republicans that Republicans believe government doesn't work and get elected to prove it. And you can't fall into that trap. People do elect governments to do things, to get on with things. And of course, often that is, in reform of the welfare state, explicitly aimed at decentralising, localising.
Minister David Willetts. He points to the central tension facing this government. It has a philosophy that leads it to relinquish power to small local institutions and forswear grand plans from central government. On the other hand, the temptation to exercise power is always there, partly because voters want the government to show leadership. Sure enough, if you look closely, Prime Minister David Cameron is doing things that would upset Nassim Taleb, as well as all the things that would please him. Fraser Nelson of The Spectator.
There is a great contradiction. When I interviewed Taleb recently, he was praising David Cameron, saying how much he liked the man and liked his ideas. But when I listed what David Cameron was actually doing, he was kind of shocked. a five-year plan. This is exactly what he hates. He used a word which I can't even repeat to describe a five-year plan, because he was saying it's just nonsense, really. These plans don't last for 5 months, let alone 5 years. Quantitative easing, he thinks this is taking a huge, big risk with the economy. So what this government is actually doing is, oddly, a textbook example of what Taleb says you shouldn't do.
So Nassim Taleb's thinking is not something that this or any government can sign up to in full, even if they wanted to pass responsibility for social and economic life to myriad others. The electorate would still hold them accountable. In fact, some of his other beliefs, when taken to their ultimate conclusion, are also impossible for a government to espouse, such as his wariness of economic growth as an aim of policy.
The West has never been richer, so there's no reason why we should not start focusing on wisdom of survival and sustainability rather than just talk empty numbers like growth. Growth is meaningless.
But choosing stability over growth is a difficult political message to sell to voters if they feel
economically squeezed. If you phrase it right, they'll understand. Voters are not foolish.
The Prime Minister would certainly disagree with Taleb on growth, although he has talked about the importance of things other than GDP, such as quality of life and social cohesion. But he and ministers like David Willetts are presiding over some ambitious projects that Taleb might regard as foolhardy.
Are you worried that Taleb's influence could see the Tories becoming a do-nothing party?
Well, this is an opportunity to make a confession. And the confession is as follows, that one of my responsibilities here is the Minister for Space. And I commissioned one of our leading experts to write a technology roadmap for space over the next 5 years. Now, I think in terms of Taleb's arguments in Black Swan, he would be pretty sceptical about that. And I think that it was a worthwhile exercise. Nobody can be sure what the space industry is going to look like in 5 years' time. But nevertheless, those type of decisions we should take. It's an important part of the growth strategy we take them. And we shouldn't be crippled by a sense of such ignorance about the future that we fail to decide anything.
So clearly, the government doesn't agree with Nassim Taleb on everything. And politicians have been known to go in for intellectual fads, only to lose interest when faced by the realities of power. But senior Tories do use his work as a guiding philosophy. What does that tell us about them? That their view of the world is a traditional conservative one. It stands for scepticism towards grand plans and favours the small and the local over the big and the central. It's not the kind of conservatism that Margaret Thatcher represented. She had a radical economic vision and often centralised power to get it implemented. Nassim Taleb's ideas appeal to old-fashioned conservatives. For all his youth and modernising spirit, that's the kind of conservative Prime Minister David Cameron is. A final thought from Nassim Taleb.
So I'm closer to the conservatives because they are sceptical of top-down rationalistic systems. And I think that we live in an environment in which we have enough alienation from our natural habitat. So you have distortions brought about by markets. But at the same time, I'm very sceptical about the rationalism of governments. So maybe I'm naturalist, or whatever you want to call it, conservationist.
How might Britain be better for all this old-fashioned conservatism? Well, Nassim Taleb's fans in government would say that we would be more able to withstand economic downturns. Our education system would allow trial and error rather than one possibly mistaken vision imposed from above. The local mayors and police commissioners might push us towards the city-state model that Nassim Taleb says has been so robust throughout history. The critics say this is an abdication of responsibility. They also ask, what are these black swan events that all this robustness would guard against? Another financial crash? An educational fad that doesn't work? But the point is, we don't know.
Analysis was presented by Janan Ganesh. The producer was Mukul Devachand. For our terms and conditions, please go to the BBC Radio 4 website. And if you download the programme next week, you'll hear Francis Stoner Saunders asking, what is money?
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.